From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made with a car ride, one that was made 30 to 40 times over the course of a summer. A family with Rochester ties made the drive from their home in Massachusetts to the University of Rochester Medical Center, a six-hour trip, so their son could receive important treatment. Kate White and her husband Justin made the drive for their son, Teddy, who had been diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Justin said his head was spinning when Teddy was diagnosed, and then there were decisions to make, one that brought them to Rochester during that summer, and now here as residents. When a parent hears their newborn or a young child has a genetic condition that could affect the rest of their lives, they may be scared, confused, or have questions about what they could do next. Research in gene therapy has led to significant changes in how doctors work with families on those questions. And this hour, we sit down with local mothers. We're going to talk with the experts. We're going to talk about how families are accessing care, what is available, what's actually happening now. And we're going to try to do that in a fact-based, straightforward way here. And let me welcome our guests here. First of all, Kate White is here. Kate is a doctor of physical therapy, a physical therapist in the orthopedics department at the University of Rochester Medical Center, creator of Team Teddy 5K. That's an annual fundraiser for Duchenne muscular dystrophy research. Welcome. Great
Thank
to have you.
You.
Thank you for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me.
You all have such long titles, except for Emily Hesney Lynch. Emily is a parent of a child who received gene therapy, and nice to have you back here. It's been a little while.
Yeah,
nice
it's good to
see
be
you.
Back. Thanks, Evan.
Welcome to Dr. Bo Lee. Dr. Lee is an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics and Neurology, Child Neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome to Dr. Sam McKenzie, an assistant professor in the Departments of Neurology, Neuroscience, and Pediatrics and the Center for Health and Technology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome. Thanks for
Thank
being here.
Thank you, Evan. Big fan.
Kate, let me just start with you. We mentioned, you know, those drives that you were making. Take us through a little bit more of that story and the decision to make that six-hour drive repeatedly and what was kind of going through your minds with your husband and
sure.
what your family was dealing with.
So we were originally received care at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, and we heard word that there was an available spot for the gene therapy program here through Sarepta. So we basically decided that wherever we needed to go, we would go. University of Rochester had a special connection to us. It's where actually my husband Justin graduated for undergraduate years ago. So he was familiar with the area. And it wasn't really until we met all the doctors and the staff that we knew that would really be a part of our lives for the next 2 years. It was after that point that we decided this was definitely the place for us. So we enlisted, and with that, it required weekly blood drives for 3 months, weekly blood work for 3 months, mm-hmm. And that occurred over 2 summers. And so for the majority of the summer of 22 and 23, we made a weekly drive here up to Rochester for his blood work. Although it was daunting and it was 6 hours one way, we made the best of it and discovered how much we really liked the Rochester area. And we actually moved here just this September.
We're going to talk more about Kate's story in a moment here. I mean, that's an extraordinary commitment. But let me just kind of pull back a little bit, because when we hear about newborn screening, we hear about gene therapy, these are sort of big terms, and I don't want to assume that I know what I'm talking about, let alone the listeners. So can I ask the doctors, if Drs. McKenzie and Lee want to talk a little bit about what it is here as a backdrop to what we're talking about, and you want to start with some general info on this here?
Sure. So, when I talk to patients and families about genetic diseases, and Bo can certainly chime in, I kind of frame it and use the analogy as a cookbook. So our DNA is sort of like a cookbook, right? And within that cookbook, we have all of these different recipes. And these recipes are called genes, and these genes make proteins in our body. So if we have a page torn out of that cookbook or a misspelling in the recipe, you can imagine that that's going to have some negative impact on the body's or the cell's ability to make a given protein. And in Kate's case, her son has a condition where it's missing a protein known as dystrophin, so that affects the muscle. And in Emily's case, we'll get to that, it's a different protein and it affects a different part of the body, but also causes weakness in kids. So with both of these conditions, The fascinating thing with gene therapy is we essentially take a engineered gene and package it in a way that it's able to get delivered to those cells that need that gene. And then that cell is then able to use that recipe to make the deficient protein. It's really sounds like science fiction, but it's happening.
How long have you science fiction writers been able to turn this into reality? It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I will say that gene therapy in the course of history is a relatively new thing. For SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, we have been doing it since 2018. So it's relatively new. And then I will also just kind of chime in to say that newborn screening, because you had asked about that, is sort of a public health program whereby we screen infants just shortly after birth for conditions that are treatable. And nearly, 99%+ of infants get newborn screened in the United States.
And again, that's kind of screening really started in earnest when?
It started back in the 1960s, okay. And it started with a disorder called phenylketonuria, or PKU for short. And so some people might actually still remember the test as the PKU test. And for many, many years, that was the only condition screened. But now we're up to about 38 conditions that are on the recommended uniform screening panel.
Parents don't need to request the screening, but you can decline it if you choose. I think that's correct, right?
In many states, you can decline it, but it happens in different ways. So in some states, you can decline it based on religious beliefs. In other states, you have to, actually write a formal request saying that you decline it. So by and far, most newborns, whether parents know it or not, actually get newborn screening done.
And it's just a blood draw from a newborn's heel?
Correct.
Okay. Pretty straightforward?
Pretty straightforward.
I don't think my son remembers it. He's 12 now. I don't think he has any recollection.
You probably don't remember it either. I mean, I know that there's a lot going on.
And honestly, that's a place of privilege, to be honest, but I don't have any recollection of that.
Yeah, so. And just to clarify, the newborn screening and how it relates to gene therapy, not all of these conditions have a gene therapy. A lot of these have dietary modification that we can implement. If they're deficient in some enzyme. But the key with newborn screening is that there has to be at least some sort of intervention available that would change the course of that disease. So that's one of the criteria for getting on the RUSP that Dr. Lee mentioned.
I'm looking at the data, and this is not the typical, but it is not at all off the map unusual here. New York State data shows 1 in 300 babies born in this state have positive screens, but 1 in 300. Doctors, does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think the other part to know about newborn screening is that it is not just genetic disorders. So a large majority of them are what we call inborn errors of metabolism, but there are things like congenital hypothyroidism, which we treat by giving exogenous thyroid. And that is probably one of the most common positive screens. It's not necessarily a genetic condition.
Okay. And just because a sibling has a negative screen doesn't mean that a new baby would have the same results, right?
Correct.
Okay. So very valuable. But that doesn't mean that everyone's going to react to a positive screen the same way. Just before we kind of work through Kate and Emily's story a little bit more here, let me just make sure listeners understand. So you talked a little bit about what you're screening for. Do doctors have a comprehensive list of what exactly you're screening for here, what you're looking for with this test?
There, you can find that information because every state has a different screening panel.
I mean, it's like several dozen different disorders, is that right?
Yeah, New York State screens for more than 40 conditions, whereas there are other states that might screen closer to 20 or 30 conditions. So every state is different, but you can find information on what disorders your state screens for online.
Okay.
As a parent, Evan, they sent me home with a little booklet about all the disorders, but I certainly did not look at it in the first couple days since I got home from the hospital. So there's resources with the information for the parent, but you're a little overwhelmed in those early days.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very relatable. Well, so we heard a little Kate's story. We're going to come back to it. Let me pick up Emily's story. So They gave you that booklet, but when did you know that there was a positive test with your child?
So we were in a kind of unique situation because we'd been readmitted to the hospital for jaundice. We were home for about 2 nights, and he was extremely jaundiced. The pediatrician told us to check back in and get some phototherapy. So we had finally gotten back to strong, and he was all checked in under the lights and everything. I saw a lactation consultant. They were just leaving, and then there was a knock at the door, and someone said, oh, there's someone here from neurology to see you. And we were like, oh, what does that mean? And then Sam walked in, and we got the news of the positive test result for SMA.
How do you have that conversation, Dr. McKenzie?
It's a different conversation in every circumstance. So I think the first thing is meeting parents where they are. You kind of give a level of understanding for, you know, what do they understand about genetics and these different conditions. And honestly, it's a lot easier conversation to have now where we have treatments available than it probably was 10, 20 years ago. So I'd like to start with as much as possible, you know, acknowledging that this is already hard. You know, I've had three, I'm a father of three, and, you know, it's not easy having a newborn in the first place, not easy to be readmitted to the hospital. So acknowledging that, and then kind of priming them that, you know, they're going to get an info dump. And if anything requires clarification or further explanation, or we just need to pause, that I kind of make clear at the outset, and then we just go from there. And different people can handle different amounts of information at that initial visit. And I think you just need to be prepared that a lot of it's going to need to be repeated because we don't remember a lot of it if you know, people are giving us that news.
Especially when you're talking about a positive test, a genetic condition. When Emily talks behind your back, she says really positive
things. Well, that's nice of her. Yeah.
She really does. because that moment is not one that anybody can be prepared for. And it is a lot to learn quickly. What do you remember about the way you were processing it, Emily?
It is funny. I was chatting with my husband yesterday about what we each remembered. And Sam had done a little drawing for us that I tried to dig out before coming here. And I was like, oh, he drew Punnett squares. And we were talking about biology class. And it was not a drawing of Punnett squares. It was a drawing of the treatment options and the deletions and the genes and all of that kind of thing. I remember wanting to, like, cut to the chase more quickly, like rip off the Band-Aid, tell me exactly what's going to happen with my son. Is he going to be able to walk, or is he going to be in a wheelchair forever? Like, what are we looking at? Is my life going to be radically different? And I'm going to be caretaking it a much more intense level than I anticipated. Meanwhile, my husband had been an engineer at a company that made optical systems for genetic sequencing machines. So he had a lot of background to ask a lot of really detailed questions. And I was like, we don't need the details.
You're
now.
Like, you're the big picture person.
Yeah, and you don't know what the outcome is going to be in that moment either. So it's just a lot to take in all at once.
Do you want to describe a little bit more about what you've learned about your son and what the considerations you had for what to do about it?
Yeah, Sam had outlined the three main treatment options for SMA. And from the start, it seemed like gene therapy was probably the best option for us. So we wanted to go for that. My son was born 4 weeks early. So he was jaundiced and tiny and all his organs were still coming online. So there are a lot of things that had to be checked out and made sure he was able to actually handle the gene therapy because they use a virus to send that into his body. And we wanted to make sure he could deal with that. So it was a lot of like blood draws and different tests, the liver ultrasound and echocardiogram, and all this heart stuff, like seeing your teeny tiny 6-pound baby hooked up to all these wires and having his blood taken a few times a week. And it's a lot of very intense and emotional and draining experiences along the way to get to the gene therapy day.
Dr. McKenzie, well, maybe this is really for both the doctors. Is there a growing group, just the data of what parents are deciding to do? Is there a growing group who decide to go with the treatments that are available as opposed to saying, I don't know what this is, I'm nervous about this, how does that typically break down?
Absolutely. So I think first step is kind of, again, presenting the palette of options. And we're lucky to have, again, three FDA-approved treatments in the case of spinal muscular atrophy. For Duchenne, I think we're up to 8 FDA-approved treatments. And there really is not a clear right or wrong. I mean, I have my preferences, but there are risks with almost any medicine. And so I try to present that palette of options to a family and say, look, here are the risks. here's the evidence that this might be more effective than another. And I think to get back to your point about deciding on a treatment, as long as there is some treatment plan, speaking personally, I'm pretty okay with that. We get into ethical situations, and I think that can come back to a lack of understanding. If parents decide not to pursue treatment, that's probably a different conversation, just because we know how much of an impact these medications have had on quality of life and survival. And in pediatrics, actually, it becomes a stickier situation if parents opt to not treat one of these conditions at all.
They can, right? Parents can opt not to treat. Is that...
It's a tricky...
We're looking at each other.
Yeah, we're looking at each other because it's kind of a tricky situation, especially with spinal muscular atrophy. I think the context to know is that spinal muscular atrophy, especially the more severe type, what we call type 1, has a very well-described clinical course, or what we call natural history. So we know that only 8% of untreated children will survive past their second birthday. And this is completely untrue if you treat them. And so we, you know, thankfully have not encountered any family who was opposed to or have decided to forego any treatment now that there are 3 available treatments. But I do think that in that particular scenario with spinal muscular atrophy, that might be a bigger ethical discussion should we run into that scenario.
And Evan, I don't want to interject, but just to kind of provide a little context on this condition, the way I talk about it, it's almost like ALS for little babies. So we have motor neurons in our spinal cord that control our muscles, and those are the cells that die in SMA. And we have kind of a backup copy of this gene, and the more of this backup copy we have in our bodies, we are able to produce more of it. So that kind of dictates the severity and the onset of symptoms, broad strokes in these kids. But to Beau's point, the efficacy is so clear. Only one of these treatments is a gene therapy, but there are 2 others that also boost this protein through that backup copy. We really do push some form of treatment, but it really comes down to risk and benefit for the individual families in terms of what they choose.
Before the program, talking briefly to Dr. McKenzie, I had just mentioned that trying to learn a little bit about what, if there are objections to gene therapies, what they are. And I didn't see too much in this super politicized world. I kind of thought I'd see a little bit more. There's some objections. You know, I saw the phrase playing God. I saw, you know, some religious raising possible religious objections. Have you encountered any of that?
Personally, no, okay. I haven't. And I think that I can certainly understand those points. So I don't want to minimize it. I would love to hear actually from our families, because I think until you've lived it and it's your child, it's sort of a theoretical concept.
Dr. Lee, have you heard any like that?
I have only had one encounter where there was concern about gene therapy, and I think it was more of a misunderstanding about what gene therapy is, because the question or concern we heard back was, I don't want you to change my child's genes. And that's definitely not what we're doing. We're giving a gene. In SMA, it's really amazing because the gene is small enough that we can package the entire SMN gene into a little viral capsid and give that to the body. But we are not, that doesn't integrate into our own DNA. And so we are not changing someone's genes.
So let me try to put let's move Emily's story forward here, and then we're going to talk to Kate. So in your experience, you know, husband's been an engineer. He's a smarty science type. You know, there's a lot that you're dealing with very quickly. Did it even occur to you to think, well, I don't know if we want to do anything here?
I think we certainly were not considering doing nothing, but he did immediately know of all those ethical concerns that some people have.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, interesting. Yeah. And so the treatment for your son started at less than a month old, yes?
Yeah, so he was on a treatment in between called risdiplam, which is one of the ones that boosts the other gene. So that was like an oral thing he took at home for 2 weeks leading up to the gene therapy. And then we stopped that and he got gene therapy at 26 days old.
26 days.
And it was the day before his due date since he was early. So
oh my gosh.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Amazing. How's he doing?
He's doing really well. Yesterday, he rolling over finally clicked for him, and he is just rolling all over the place, and he is so proud of himself. It's very cute and very exciting.
How did your experience with the actual gene therapy, I am totally ignorant here. Was this a one-day treatment? Is there a follow-up? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So it is a wild thing to experience. Yeah. We had so much buildup to it, and then they prepare the drug, and we waited for a while for the pharmacy to get it ready. It's an IV infusion that takes an hour. It was 19 milliliters of a clear fluid going into his arm, and he slept the whole time. Then he got monitored for 3 hours, and we went home. And that's it.
That's it, doctor.
It breaks your brain a little bit.
Yeah. That's one time.
It's very fast and sort of anticlimactic. I've heard that expression before about the actual treatment. I think the follow-up and monitoring for potential side effects, that's where the real work comes in from our standpoint and certainly the parents and the kids.
What possible side effects are there?
So again, we're packaging these gene constructs in a virus. And what we do is basically infuse trillions of these viral particles into the bloodstream. And this is a particular virus that doesn't cause disease in human beings, but it still can cause inflammation and kind of an immune response. And so our hope is that that virus gets to the cells that it needs to target, but a lot of it ends up in the liver, for example, which filters the blood. And so we can see liver inflammation that can show up as elevated liver enzymes. We can sometimes see cardiac enzymes go up. And, in other gene therapies, this is not a benign treatment. There have been deaths in some trials, not in these particular instances that we're talking about today. But it's, again, it's not a benign treatment. And so there's a risk to gene therapy that we are very cognizant of and we're very careful about, which is why we see these patients very regularly and why, in Kate's experience, she had to come 6 hours from Connecticut week after week.
Well, Emily, I'm glad to hear that he's doing great. Good luck with mobility. It's great.
It's going to be a doozy.
It's also terrible.
I left him on the floor after a diaper change to wash my hands for 10 seconds, and I came back, and he was on his belly like, hello.
we're good
changed.
With that.
Yeah. let me turn to Kate White. Let's back up here. And can you describe then a little bit more about what you're learning about Duchenne? How much did you know about Duchenne before the diagnosis and the speed at which you felt like you had to make yourself an expert to make decisions?
Well, I would say fortunately and unfortunately at the same time, because I'm a physical therapist, I actually knew what Duchenne muscular dystrophy was. My husband did not. So that was not a fun thing to already know. But I will say our journey was different than Emily's, because in the world of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, newborn screening is not in every state, and it's a relatively new thing since 2018. My son was born in 2017. So it was not even on the spectrum of possibilities. Now we have an older son who has another unrelated rare genetic condition. And we got tested. My husband and I were tested through the wazoo for every single possible carriers of something, and we were negative. We weren't carriers, but they did not test me for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So it turns out I'm actually a carrier of it. But anyway, because he wasn't diagnosed at such a young age, Duchenne generally is not diagnosed until the average age of around 4. Because that's when those boys, typically boys, there are females affected too. Not only carriers, but women and girls have Duchenne. But basically, it was just over time, I knew he was not on time with all of his things. As a physical therapist, I knew he was delayed for all of his skills. So for us, our diagnostic journey was a little bit different. It took 6 months to get in with a neurologist. It took another 6 months to get a developmental pediatrician. So our diagnostic journey was a year in length. And basically, we knew that it could have been that. We were initially told that he had something else. And so then when we found out that it was Duchenne, because of having an ultrasound, and it was at that time that the doctor, this was at a different hospital, was showing me my son's muscle on ultrasound, and from what she showed me and what I knew, I knew it was Duchenne. She basically said, "It's Duchenne," and walked out of the room. My husband and I were left in tears, and for us at that time, gene therapy wasn't really a big thing for Duchenne yet. It was still it was a possibility, but it wasn't really there yet. So we knew that we could start him on steroids. So we did that. So for us, our journey was just a lot longer. We were very lucky that we were diagnosed so young, because when he was the age of 4, that's when he was eligible for gene therapy. So we knew we wanted to do it, and that's when we started.
I'm sorry about what you went through just in terms of getting that news.
Thank you.
It should be better than that, and I know the professionals in the room agree with that.
That's why we changed hospitals. That's why we're here.
Yeah. But I do want to make sure people understand, because Duchenne is, you said almost exclusively boys.
Yes. You could say that, but yes, there are females that have it, and there are actually girls currently getting gene therapy for it.
Okay. And you want to add to that, doctor?
Duchenne muscular dystrophy is an X-linked disorder, and because boys have just one X and they have the Y chromosome, and girls have two X's, they sort of have a backup. And so girls tend to be carriers and therefore can pass it on to their boys. There are rare instances where we use the term manifesting carriers, where you have a girl who is symptomatic and very similar in clinical characteristic to a boy with Duchenne, but it's much, much less common.
Doctor, can you describe what a typical progression of Duchenne is throughout someone who has Duchenne throughout their life experience with it?
Yeah, so I think we know some, but not we don't have a lot of precision about the very early years, because as Kate talked about, there is this sort of diagnostic delay or diagnostic odyssey that that families go through, and so the average age of diagnosis is around 4 to 5. But we, in our personal experience, have certainly seen kids who are diagnosed even several years beyond that. So in the early years, there may be some mild motor delays, things like achieving independent walking a little bit later than their peers. And then in the early school age years is when you really start to notice this difficulty keeping up with their same age peers. So on the playground, they might be falling more often, be slower than their friends. And that's what we hear a lot from our first initial visits when we might be thinking about Duchenne. And it is a progressive muscle disorder. So boys with Duchenne just historically tend to lose ambulation in their early to mid teenage years, and end up in a wheelchair. And that kind of is a pivotal moment in their health, because it's often followed by sort of progression of their ability to breathe on their own over time, as well as their cardiac or heart health.
So can I ask how Teddy's doing now?
Sure. So Teddy is now in first grade. He is running around. He's on the playground. He's doing all those things. He cannot ride a bike, but he's doing well. He now basically can just go to any doctor's office. He's so used to it that it's just part of his DNA. It's part of his routine now. So he's doing well. There are a lot of other behavioral ramifications, unfortunately, with Duchenne as well. A lot of those boys can have OCD tendencies, and a lot are diagnosed with autism, because the brain is also lacking protein. So we're currently dealing with a lot of those issues right now. Physically, he's doing great. He has the biggest dimples you've ever seen. But, you know, we are dealing with a 6-year-old on steroids who has some OCD tendencies. So other than that, things are great.
Have you thought about, I mean, Kate, you went into this probably with a little bit more knowledge than a lot of parents when they
sure.
get that, when they learn about Duchenne. And so you understand historically what that's meant for lifespans and things like that.
Yep.
I know it's not easy to talk about this.
That's okay.
But have you thought about Teddy, and are you more hopeful that that is changing and evolving, you know, when you think about his own future?
Sure. I mean, the reason we signed up for it was to extend his life. So we are hopeful that because he's walking well now, that he will be delayed until he's in a wheelchair. So we're not denying that he's going to be in a wheelchair because gene therapy, although it's wonderful, it's not a cure for Duchenne. It delays the loss of muscle, but it is still inevitable. So for us, it's just the timing. So for us, we are more prepared now. We just moved into a ranch home and we're designing it. We're redoing it to know that we might have a son in a wheelchair. And we, I think because of the gene therapy though, it's more hopeful. It's not, we know we've done whatever we can do. And our goal with him, with any treatments that come about, is to do the most for our son that is safe and that can promote his lifespan.
And Dr. Lee, similar to the question for Dr. McKenzie about side effects or even the evolution of gene therapy and treatment here, where things are today is where they will be in 5 or 10 years? Or are we seeing trials? Are there improving therapies? Is there a hope that in the future that this is even more effective? Are there concerns about side effects? What do we know there?
Yeah, so I think the side effects from a conceptual standpoint are very similar to what Sam talked about. But in practicality, Duchenne boys are older, so they are getting an even larger load of these medications. And so the side effect can be amplified in that way. I think that we will be in a very different place because we have an explosion of therapeutics for things like Duchenne muscular dystrophy right now in trial and in the lab even. And a lot of that is focused on improving the gene therapy that we have available, whether that be so we can engineer this the Duchenne or the DMD product to be more effective at getting to the muscles, getting to the heart where we need it to be. And so I think with more time, we'll only become more precision and safer, hopefully safer medications.
And let me also ask, Kate, you know, when you think about Teddy and you think about the future and you say you're trying to extend, you know, his life, his physical health, you understand probably in the future he'll need a wheelchair. A good friend of mine who was on this program talked about being in a rare category of adults who get diagnosed with something called Stargardt. So he's losing his vision. Often it's kids who get diagnosed with Stargardt. His diagnosis was in his late 30s. And he is constantly, he's on a drug now, very expensive drug. And we're going to talk about equity access in just a moment here. But he's also always wondering, are we like going to find out that there's a therapy that actually reverses this? That, you know, right now it's trying to hold off the progression of his condition, but he is not going to give up on this idea that research will take us in a place that actually reverses conditions. Is that part of your hope? Is that even a realistic part of this? Or because I don't know.
Sure.
In the realm of Duchenne, what that looks like.
That's where CRISPR comes in. CRISPR is gene editing. It's not safely here yet for humans, but there's a great book about it from the creator of CRISPR. And so basically that's when you come into question of, you know, you're really changing things, but that's what we need. So gene therapy is great, but like Emma and Sam said, it's because it's such a huge viral load that unfortunately right now you can only have gene therapy performed once, and then you have antibodies and you can't get it again. So us, we're waiting for either gene therapy again in the future after they figure out how to wash away all those antibodies, or we're waiting for CRISPR. So it's a big thing, but it still needs a lot of research. And as much as we want to do whatever we can, I don't know that I would sign up my son to be the first recipient. But that's what we need.
It is remarkable. Let me ask the doctors about some of that. Dr. Lee, what would you say about how you see the future of this kind of therapy?
Yeah, I think that genetic therapies as a whole are just going to continue to grow. There are lots of ways in which we do genetic therapy. One is giving the actual gene and replacing it. Others, which are further sort of not yet quite to clinical use, like CRISPR, where you edit the gene. I think that we are going into a space where we're going to see a lot more different strategies to help with genetic disorders.
And I'll just jump in. I think it's really informed by the specific, what we call variant, that we're talking about in a gene. So to go back to the cookbook analogy, a recipe might be missing a word, and so CRISPR might go in and insert that word or correct a misspelling. But sometimes we can use whiteout, right? So there's a whole range of therapeutics in the Duchenne space that we call exon skipping agents, which we don't need to get into the nitty gritty, but essentially we can restore some expression of that gene product by deleting part of the gene that's adjacent to one of these mistakes. So it's really informed by the particular DNA that a person has, and that's precision medicine, and it's a very exciting time to be practicing in the space.
The book's called The Code Breaker.
Yes.
There we go.
And it's by Walter Isaacson. And Jennifer Doudna is the founder of CRISPR.
Producer Megan Mack, thank you very much. Yeah, you would recommend The Code Breaker, it sounds like, Kate. Yeah. There you go. So I want to talk about access here, because when we talk about how remarkable these developments are, we also know that historically, when we see big developments in medicine and therapies, they're not always available. They are always available to people with all the money in the world. But if you're not in that category, which is not most people, they may not be as available. They may not be covered by insurance. So let's talk a little bit about this. Kate, I'll start with you. Treatment in this case, not cheap, but covered. Is that correct?
Well, in our case, we were actually very lucky to be engaged in the gene therapy trial for Sarepta because it was zero out of pocket for us. That's not the case. It's currently market value of $3.2 billion.
Million.
Jeez, I was not billion.
Not,
sorry.
Not billion.
Excuse
little.
Me.
$3.2 million.
That
seems
would be right. I mean, it's already out of reach.
It's high enough.
Wait, so $3.2 million.
Correct. So
now mine won't sound expensive.
So the problem is, in getting the gene therapy is obviously insurance denials. Insurance doesn't want to pay $3.2 million for one person. So we're running into the problem where this has been FDA approved and parents have to write letters again and again and again in order to get the gene therapy. And the kicker was it's now open label for any ages now. Not long ago, it was only ages 4 to 7. So there were kids aging out at 7 years old and 1 month. And if their insurance didn't approve it by that time, they didn't get it. So there are kids that were denied it and now that are older and their disease has progressed. So it's ridiculous how we have this drug or this treatment and families like mine have to beg and fight. And this isn't the only case. This isn't the only drug or treatment that we have to fight for. There are families that fight for steroids that insurance companies only want to pay for prednisone. They don't want to pay for the insurance for the steroid that's known to cause better outcomes because it's more expensive. So I was lucky. We were lucky. It was not of cost to us, but another treatment that we're seeking right now, something to help with fibrosis, insurance is denying it.
And what grounds?
Cost.
Just the money.
Just the money.
It's great. It's a great system. Dr. Lee, when you talk to patients and they're, I'm sure among the many questions is, can we afford this? Is it covered? What are you telling people?
Because these medications are extremely expensive, we always go through what we call a prior authorization process, mm-hmm. where we get commitment from insurance companies to that they will have coverage. That process can be short if it's immediately approved, or it can be much more prolonged where parents have to write letters, and we certainly write a lot of appeals to overturn initial denials. But we don't go ahead usually and treat anyone without that sort of in place for these particular medications.
That's got to be agonizing, though, for families.
Yes.
Boy. Emily Hesney Lynch, for your child, again, not 3.2 million, but what can you tell us about what that process was like?
So we were told the cost was 2.2 million.
Oh, and bargain.
I know, such a bargain.
2.2 million.
Yes. When the explanation of benefits came in the mail, it was only 1.9 million. Mm. So a little bit cheaper. Don't know.
I literally
why that
thought
was,
you were going to be like, yeah, it was like 10K.
No.
$2.2 million. Dollars. Okay.
We are on Child Health Plus for our son, and the New York State coverage has been amazing. So we feel really fortunate to have that. We're both self-employed, so we're on the New York State marketplace, and then he qualified for that plan.
Okay. So out of pocket's been?
Just the $60 a month fee for the plan. It's wild. Yeah. We feel very lucky. He did have to take a bridge treatment in between that I believe was $400,000 for a single bottle of the medicine, but there was a manufacturer's grant program that got us the medicine for free. So,
Dr. McKenzie, what's going to change this? I mean, it does not feel like we're on a collision course for a really good system of access and equity here.
No, I think that's a fair point. And before, you know, people start calling in and directing their ire at the University of Rochester, Bo and I don't see a cent, you know, on our paycheck for treating. And I think most of that cost is really put in place by the companies that are manufacturing the drug. So just to be clear about that. But it's certainly complicated. And you know, with the whole going back to the drug development landscape, there's a huge expense, huge failure rate to designing, manufacturing, bringing a therapeutic through clinical trials, a lot of risk. And then on the other end of that, once you have a approval, I think it just comes down to any other business, right? And I'm not being an apologist for the pharmaceutical industry, but I think that's where a lot of those costs come from. It's more of a societal and systemic setup that's how we've decided to create drugs in this country.
But the patents last for a pretty long time, don't they?
They do, and you know, and with these gene therapies, very custom products with very rigorous manufacturing standards, and you know, we don't need to get into that. But these aren't drugs that you could, you know, start a generic drug company and start making tomorrow. It would take some time. So I don't even know that the patent landscape really informs a lot about cost long term.
Okay, so what is going to bring down cost?
Oof. That's another hour. I think we need another hour. But you know, I'm acknowledging it's a big problem. We have it's a good problem to have in some ways. I mean, I'd rather have expensive therapeutics that we have to fight with insurance companies to administer than not have therapeutic options at all. But we really need to kind of put our heads together, I think, from a government standpoint, from a business standpoint, certainly across the healthcare sector, patient community. And think about what we can do better, because it's not a sustainable course.
And it wasn't all smooth sailing for us either. We did have a denial because he was on that bridge treatment, so they didn't want to give us gene therapy. So that was a whole thing to sort out with insurance as well. And the neurology department did have a person on their team who helped us liaise with insurance, and they got it turned around within like 20 minutes on a Friday afternoon. But still, not something you want to deal with when your tiny baby needs help.
Yeah. Dr. Lee, how are we going to make these more affordable?
I don't think that I have any better answers.
Come on, I'll give you the keys to the system. You get to redesign the system however you want.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I don't have a good answer for this one. But I do recognize this problem, especially with disorders with like newborn screening. The newborn screening program has to be equitable, but the access afterwards has to be equitable as well. And this is a big, big problem that I do not personally have the answer to.
Well, Dr. McKenzie, you said, you know, don't anybody think that, you know, don't get upset with the URMC that we're not. Are people, did people think like, oh, well, you must be pocketing all
this? Oh, no, no, no. I just meant in the context.
I'm wondering, like, what's the accusation that's happening?
No,
here?
Just in the context of this conversation, I don't want your listeners thinking that
it's $2.2 million for you.
We're all getting rich off of this.
No.
You know, and if I did have the theoretical keys to the kingdom, I would say, you know, we need a better public infrastructure for drug development. I think more money into research. I think if we increase the competitive landscape from that standpoint, and we're not relying on, you know, venture capital to really get these drugs off the ground, because then I think there's an expectation on the back end that there's going to be some serious costs associated with those.
I'm going to dip my toe in here with a little bit of knowledge, which is dangerous here, but in some circumstances with pharma, you get a patent. Patents can last a long time, and then pharma companies can evergreen. They kind of tweak the recipe just a little. They get an extension on the patent. And so they essentially monopolize that little corner of the market. When we're in a situation where there can be probably more competitors making and bringing costs down. But it does not sound like in gene therapy, the doctors here are saying that that's the situation. We're not saying it's not an issue with patents. It's not an issue with, well, everybody could be making it, but only one has got a stranglehold or a monopoly here. It is truly a unique product that takes a lot of research and development to get to in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it leaves me wondering if the price tag is $3.2 million or $2.2 million for an individual therapy, is that because the outlay to even get there was so high that the only way to recoup it is to make it that expensive? I mean, that I'm trying to figure out why $2.2 million or $3.2 million makes sense.
This is me speaking personally. Yeah, I don't want to be uncharitable here. I think if you're working at a company, and this isn't to single out the two companies that make these products, but if you're working at a company and you're making a very customized precision medicine drug, yes, there's some recouping of cost, but I think you price it what you can get. At the price that you think you can reasonably get. So I don't have a business background, but I think it's more than a break-even proposition.
But they're not going to get that if insurance denies it. That is aggressive. That's beyond aggressive pricing. $3.2 million for a therapy.
Yep.
For a child, a family who desperately needs it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just to clarify on Kate's point, so it is FDA approved now for patients 4 years and older, and there's actually levels to the FDA approval where there's a full approval right now for any boys that are still ambulant. And the reason for that is the clinical trial results that we've done to date have really focused on that ambulant population where we're seeing most of the benefit, we think. So there's still a lot of work to be done. I mean, we have a commercially available gene therapy for Duchenne. And I think Bo's next job and my next job and all of our other colleagues at URMC and across the country and the world, we really need to be focusing on what are the long-term real-world impacts of these treatments and how can we do a better job of assigning efficacy if we have different options, because that's another way to drive down cost, right? If we're talking about competition and we have a therapeutic landscape where there are multiple options, I think that can only be a good thing.
Let me ask the parents here. What do you want to leave with other parents who may end up in your situation in the future?
I think people would give a lot of trite advice like, oh, it's gonna be okay, or don't worry too much, you'll get through it, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's important that any feeling on the whole spectrum of human emotion is valid. You're probably going to be angry and sad and scared, and you'll still want to enjoy the joyful moments with your child, and you'll also feel the uncertainty of what lies ahead. So just being aware and welcoming of all those feelings and not trying to like gaslight yourself into gratitude, or just be positive and optimistic. Like, whatever you're feeling is okay and valid.
Kate, what would you say?
Well, I have a shirt I'm actually a barbecue place that says every day is a good day. So I keep that in my head, but every day is not a good day. Okay. Especially with a 6-year-old. So it's just keeping the perspective for my husband and I, and other parents. It's like Emily said, you try to focus on those good times. You try not to dwell in the future. But you also can't, you know, turn to it. You have to know that it's there. But I would say just trying your best to live in the moment and trying to get through every day. And every day might not be a good day, but try to think that every day could be a good day.
About 30 seconds apiece. Dr. Lee, I'll start with you on the doctor side. What do you want to leave with listeners as we think about this issue?
I think we want to let people be more aware that there are rare genetic conditions that are being screened for at birth, that there are more and more treatments available, and that we as clinicians, we want to align with you. We want to take that journey with you from the beginning into the future.
Dr. McKenzie?
Yeah, I would just put in a plug for scientific research. I think we are underfunding severely research on rare disease, and it's not something that impacts you until it impacts you and you have a son born with one of these conditions. And I think we just have a big need in terms of the development efforts to bring more treatments to so many of these diseases that don't have anything.
Thank you all for being here. Sorry for my cynicism about insurance companies.
That's okay.
Understandable.
You're speaking
very
to the choir.
So.
I had a flooding issue years ago with a property and was denied a claim, but they did tell me homeowners insurance would have covered lava in case of a volcano strike had hit, but not the flooding. So I know it can be difficult for families. I do hope that in the future it doesn't take an act of God to get these therapies in people's hands. Thank you all for being here. Kate White and Emily Hesney Lynch, to your families, all the best. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bo Lee, Dr. Samuel McKenzie, thank you for the work that you're doing, making our community stronger. We appreciate your expertise.
Thanks so much.
And from all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.